Hello, friends. Welcome to the Resonance Test. I'm your host, Allison Coton, a director of innovation consulting at EPAM Continuum. Are we living in a simulation? Is anything real? And if not, what holds value as the true currency in a Gen AI-driven society? We could ask ChatGPT these questions and get some interesting synthesized echoes of science fiction, business strategy, and philosophy. Or we could hear Elena Schechter, our Chief Marketing and Strategy Officer and SVP, and Rowan Curran, Senior Analyst at Forrester, explain it all. I'm probably biased, but in this case, I think the human lens is important as we unpack how generative AI is already infusing our lives and work more deeply than we know. As Curran explains, it's no longer a question of whether a company will build generative AI into its strategy, but how creative their use cases will be to keep ahead of competition. We've gone beyond awkward text conversations with a bot to thinking about tools that help developers achieve a creative flow state or free up time so people can better balance their work and home lives. In service of pleasure and creativity, these tools take on a new potential for impact, even as the market sets a greater value on authenticity and human input. Maybe we're all about to be swallowed by the Matrix, but on the other hand, maybe this is going to be a great year at work.
So we've got kind of our AI guru. We've got many AI gurus, but one of them is Dmitry Tikhonenko, who is kind of our go-to guy on AI. And the reason he's a go-to guy is because he's both a practitioner and kind of a very passionate thought leader on many subjects related to how businesses need to be thinking about AI, not just developers. Because we have a lot of people who are thinking about how developers need to. So I go to him when I have very serious questions. I want to ask, like, hey, what do you think? Like, what's the currency of the future? What do you think, Rowan, is the currency of the future?
I mean, I think the currency of the future is the same currency that has been driving business for the past 15 years, which is information and how you can collect information, how you can store information, how you can retrieve and act on it. And I think what we're seeing in the generative AI space is, you know, a whole new range of ways to interact with that information and in different ways to create that information as well overall.
So you think information, yeah. Right? So I've been thinking about this a lot, and I sort of somewhat agree. I don't know if you saw Sam Altman's interview with Friedman. I don't know if you listened to any of his podcasts.
But I've seen clips of that. I've not seen the entirety of that podcast. Yeah.
So, I mean, Sam Altman's view is that the currency of the future is compute. I mean, I think that's a little bit extra for me for now. But certainly, I agree with you that information underpinned by data is really the currency of the future. And to the question of what should companies be doing now to make sure they're ready to benefit and succeed with AI, I mean, Dmitry's point of view is they should be getting their data ready. What's yours?
Yes. Yeah, So I like this currency of the future metaphor because I think that compute is not the currency of the future. Compute is the financial system of the future.
Yes.
So I think that I'm very much with Dmitry that, you know, data is kind of the underlying currency that you are going to use to drive the system, but how you actually, you know, interact between individuals, organizations, how you like drive the growth is going to come from like what compute and what processing you have around a lot of this stuff.
Cool. So what's real and not real in Gen AI? Dmitry's point of view is everything is real. My view is that we're likely living in a simulation, so it's as real could be, maybe. And here's his point. I thought what we could do is you could tell me, like, agree, disagree, comment.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Point one, why is it real? Well, if something doesn't work today, doesn't mean that anyone has the luxury to not try to solve why it doesn't work.
I think that that's a really great point. And honestly, I think that that actually gets at, it gets at a lot of the pushback that the generative AI space has been getting overall. So, you know, even just conversations that I've been having earlier today where people are saying, oh, you know, the large language models hallucinate, we can't possibly use them for X, Y, Z, you know, it's like this big pushback on it. But I would say, you know, what I've seen over the course of the past year has been an ebullient explosion of people working on tools and approaches to manage the outputs of models and to make sure that they are grounded in your enterprise information and to make sure that they are producing, you know, the outputs that we want in the constrained ways that we need in business context. And are we there yet in terms of like having these be, you know, optimized architectures and things like that? Absolutely not. But is there tons of work being done there? Are we approaching, you know, reasonable solutions to those problems? Yes, absolutely. And I think additionally, like especially when it comes to like the hallucination problems and stuff like that, absolutely, for a lot of like circumstances, you know, things cannot be, you know, they're going to happen 95% of the time or 98% of the time. You need a deterministic output. But in those circumstances, you probably shouldn't be using a non-deterministic model overall. But there's lots and lots of circumstances where if we have, say, a human in the loop instead of a large language model, that human is not going to be accurate or precise 100% of the time either. And what we can actually do with these systems that we sometimes can do with humans that is maybe harder is we can actually capture what those interactions are and then, say, maybe iterate on them the next time around. But I think, and then also, you know, if we even look at sort of what we were doing last year, it was all focused around language. Like large language models were the main thing. We had image generators and things like that, but it was kind of separated. And that people were very much like, all right, this is going to be like a language-based space. Whereas, you know, and even, you know, the past 2 months, we've had a number of increases in availability of multimodal large language models, which are, again, kind of changing the game in terms of, like, what use cases are possible. Like, I know we're not going to kind of go into use cases because that's, you know, what a lot of people have been talking about. But now we have a whole new world of use cases that are opened up by being able to look at, say, an enterprise process diagram and have a language model describe to you what it's doing and me as a bit like a end user, I don't really need to understand the technical details of that. So sorry, that was a long-winded way of saying, yes, I totally agree with him that there's like problems to be approached, but you know, we shouldn't give up on the whole space just because not everything is perfect.
I don't think it's giving up. I think my question was, like, is being a Luddite as a company an option? And I think his view, Davinci's view, is that it's not an option because...
And yes.
Sorry, said, go ahead. Whatever the competitive edge that you had as an organization in 2022, and I happen to agree with his point of view, I just wonder what you think. Whatever your competitive edge you thought you had in 2022, it's a different mode of operations, and the positioning, regardless of whether your current AI efforts are failing or succeeding, has got to be only accelerating around along the vector of AI, because the opportunity to get away from the competition faster is much greater now than it ever has been. So, we talked about sort of the multiple modality lens.
Yeah.
I had a conversation earlier today with the guy who leads our educational offerings, and we're actually doing quite a bit in AI-assisted learning and AI kind of native learning. And it's interesting because the progress the technology is making is pretty impactful. And we had a 40-minute discussion on the economic model that results from it. And I'm wondering kind of just where you sit, because you see so many different use cases and you see so many of these advancements kind of in the world being talked about as, wow, these are so cool. What are your thoughts sort of as far as once the promise becomes more real, what is the impact on commercial and economic models in being able to deploy these platforms and business applications at scale?
Yeah, so it's going to be a significant impact overall. And I think to go back to something we were talking about earlier about whether people can be Luddites or not, I absolutely don't think people can just kind of sit by the wayside and not experiment with this stuff. But I think it's important to realize that one of the reasons for that is that, you know, right now, everybody's kind of building the Gen 1 of enterprise generative AI applications. But those are going to be ubiquitous. And so if you are not looking at adopting those applications, even if it is just getting it from a provider or, you know, as a package capability, you are going to be falling behind everybody else who is actually building with this stuff today.
Remember when I was telling you about kind of where EPAM is?
Yep.
So we went from last year from having a lot of POCs to pilots.
Yep.
This year, we've got a lot of pilots across every vertical, across kind of every business function you can imagine. Maybe there are extras that we haven't done, but we've done enough. And those pilots are now on sort of the cusp of becoming programs that are deployed into production. And once they're in production, then the question is, what does that look like at scale? And then the question becomes, okay, what is the impact on the economic model? Who gets the benefit of the value? How do we charge for these kinds of services? And I don't mean just a service provider like EPAM. I mean, the end customer doesn't necessarily want to pay for AI either.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on sort of the impact on the commercial economic environment when AI succeeds? And then we can talk about what happens when it fails.
Yeah. So I think this is one of the golden questions of 2024. So 2023, as you said, I kind of talk about 2023 as the year of excitement and experimentation, and 2024 is the year of optimization and efficiency. And so I think as people are kind of rolling, into like the full-blown production of these things, they are really trying to, dial in how they are measuring the impact of this stuff in order to look at what the efficiencies gained are. So I think one of the big things that we've seen in terms of the economic model and the impact around this stuff is folks are getting much more deliberate and specific about A, how they are designing the metrics around their use cases. So if we're taking like Copilot writ broadly, for example, people are talking about, okay, we're going to deploy it to this number of employees and we expect to see X amount of impact. And it'll be, this amount of savings. Well, that doesn't really take into account, that employees do different things. People of different job roles or job levels have very different salaries. So somebody saving 30 minutes per day who makes, $60K a year is going to have a very different economic impact on the company versus somebody who makes, $200K a year and saves 30 minutes per day. And so there's that layer of nuance to add into sort of the use case understanding. But then there's also the need to understand that you don't necessarily need the latest and greatest and biggest and baddest and best model to, summarize your call center transcripts, for example. And so one of the things that we are seeing with folks is that a lot of experimentation and prototyping happened with, or the initial betas also happened with the large proprietary models from the big providers. And while those models are still being used to a great degree, we've seen a huge proliferation of the usage of open source models, particularly in a hybridized fashion with some of the proprietary models. And that has been one of the ways that folks have really started to say, all right, we know this works, we know this provides like good functionality, but how do we actually, make this not just economically viable, but how do we do this, the best, fastest, cheapest? Because as I said before, everybody's going to be trying to do this type of thing. So folks really need to optimize around how what the cost is to them and how they are deploying this stuff. And so this is driving further demand from customers for an ecosystem that allows them to manage and deploy the models within applications and then monitor once they're in production. So, I know obviously you all like released your open source orchestration tool around this, and then there's a number of other vendors that have their proprietary tools that are either monitoring the models in production or specifically looking at the FinOps aspects of running the models in production. So I think overall, what we are seeing is folks get much more deliberate about how they are thinking about the cost impacts and benefits of using these models and the applications around them. But in terms of sort of what is the optimal measurements and the optimal kind of economic model around these things, I think that is still being hammered out by a lot of folks. And in part around that is that, as we have kind of moved beyond the like, okay, we either move beyond basically basic retrieval augmented generation essentially, and into folks using much more complicated setups that are calling out to external agents, contextualizing prompts with various, types of enterprise data. That, then again draws in new questions. Okay, how are we actually like thinking about the business use case around this? How are we thinking about the implementation and the impacts of this overall? So, while we were starting to see, some folks start to be able to, draw specific, numbers on the board in terms of like economic impacts and savings of certain aspects of generative AI, other areas are still in a, a big process of optimization and, discovery, even as if we're talking about the architectures around this. And then if we look at sort of the, some of the other adjacent spaces, like all everything to do with image and video generation, the value there, has been identified to a certain degree, but we really haven't seen it sort of borne out at scale for a lot of companies there.
It's interesting. I mean, so just on the different modalities on video, in particular, there's the programs that we're working on where we're trying to really kind of drive a sea change in what it constitutes a new product with video platforms. So we're working with one of the big sports networks on something like that. And the question that I have is, and maybe you have a view, this is a technical question. I mean, what is the threshold around which a clip of a game, once it becomes generated by AI, what is the threshold beyond which people just don't want to watch it because it's generated? Like, it's one thing if it's a useful tool. It seems to me, again, I'm not a sports fan, but it seems to me, what's one thing when it's a useful tool, you know, give me a collage of all the greatest sort of holes in ones in golf or greatest last sets in tennis versus give me the ideal kind of hole in one. Like, I'm not sure if people want to pay for that. And I think that that's somewhat the business model question that I'm asking. And I don't expect there to be an answer, but I do wonder to the question of what is the currency of the future, trust is part of that, and authenticity and like watermarks will be a big part of the, it's really, really real as opposed to somewhat really real.
Yeah, the authenticity will determine whether your currency information is counterfeit or whether it's valid. So yes, totally agree with that. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be counterfeit. It could just be manufactured.
Manufactured in whatever way. Yeah, yeah. Counterfeit is too much of a value judgment on that. So I guess if we're looking at like the sports example, generated video in that context can be very useful, but it has to be very specific. So if, for example, you have like, the station header or something like that, that is showing like a montage of a bunch of different like plays and stuff like that, you know, their generative video could be very useful because maybe, you know, you don't necessarily like have the rights to all of the clips that you might want to reference and put in there. And for that circumstance, it's maybe not going to be super important for the end user experience, like the consumer of that show, to know, okay, I know what all of those exact moments were. It's just kind of like not a throwaway piece of content, but it's a piece of content where the actual like substance of it doesn't matter as much to the consumer. And so I think some of those circumstances, like generative video will be very useful. But then also I think when we're, it's important to consider kind of beyond circumstances like that in terms of, okay, how are we, like, what might we use generative video for? Well, we might use it as a way to storyboard and ideate out, you know, our new ad campaign that we are going to send out next year. And, you know, we don't want to spend the money to, you know, bring in like a whole bunch of actors or something that we might never actually end up using, but we want to like kind of build this out. So that's where I think, you know, tools like Stable Video Diffusion and if it ever gets released to the, you know, public or consumers, you know, things like Sora can be very useful. Yep. But
have you played with it at all with Sora?
I was not aware that there was any way for end users to actually mess with the prompts full on.
There was a limited access for it.
Oh, I did not get access to that, unfortunately. So I unfortunately have just been reading the papers and consuming the pieces
it. Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, same idea. I mean, we had our teeth sprayed with it for a while, and it's pretty, two steps to uncanny valley is my experience so far.
Yes.
What is yours?
So I will say, so it's funny, like when Sora came out, I had just updated my generative video section in a lot of my decks. And then I was like, okay, great. Well, this kind of ruins the entire state of the art that I had out there. So, you know, as somebody who's been paying pretty close attention to the video generation space for the past couple of years, and particularly to some of the interesting approaches that are not just generating video from scratch, but folks who are basically taking existing video and then remasking it with stuff, Sora isn't, you know, it's a big jump in terms of the quality and capabilities. Now, I don't know how handpicked some of those examples were, but in terms of the cohesion, in terms of objects and subjects and the overall like aesthetic feel of the like the multi-shot scenes, that is a big jump beyond what Stable Video Diffusion and Runway AI and some of these others are capable of today. And so to me, that was, you know, a pretty significant jump. But what was honestly more interesting to me about that particular model was not the model itself, but potential uses for it beyond it, if it in fact is actually representing the world internally when it's generating the video. So the technical paper, yeah, I know there's a lot of debate around that, but this is just, if it is true, and I'm just speculating, like maybe could possibly, but if you can generate physics in a like a very reasonable way within these video generation models, I think that opens up a lot of potential product development, testing, all these other types of capabilities that might not have been there. Now, I again want to say that could totally be an incorrect assumption and direction that they're going on that with. But to me, that was that was more interesting than the video generator itself.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, we're kind of talking, the reason I'm so interested in the economics of it is because it's actually driving a product. It's not just product development,
yeah,
product
yeah.
design and product, it's R&D, like, which is yeah. really, I think, where we'll wind up with a lot of these conversations is a lot of the optimization will fly right back into kind of an R&D discussion. Okay, we've optimized our call center. Let's talk about what the product should be. What is it? What's the service? How is it AI native? Which is this whole notion of AI native is something we've been playing around with.
Yes. Go ahead. I was just going to say, I think that that's great because I think, you know, a lot of us are like just kind of thinking about, okay, well, we can use AI for this use case or that use case. And that's great. But that's all about what are we like opening up a bottleneck in a business process, right? Like we have this flow of information or process that has to be opened up. And once we open up one of those, okay, then we can identify another one and open up that other one. And once we get to kind of two or three of those, then yeah, as you said, you can really start to rethink processes from the ground up and think about how can we design this from the get-go to be built around AI rather than just kind of trying to add it in a piecemeal kind of way.
So I wanted to share something we've been working on and get your thought. Maybe you've seen other examples of this. So as I mentioned when I saw you, we've been at sort of really looking at how it changes the engineering
yep.
job. So what happens to a software engineer with the advent of, you know, kind of the full scope of various available AI tools? I think we have a pretty good idea, even when we spoke, about what happens to the engineer. So the last, I would say, 6 months, we've been working on looking at how AI tooling changes the SDLC.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some interesting preliminary results. I'm wondering if you guys are looking at that as well and if you can share some insights.
Yeah, we are definitely looking at that for sure. So my colleague, Diego Lodijic, is kind of leading our coverage on this. We call broadly Turing bots, which is essentially how we look at the entire SDLC enhanced by AI. But we've been looking at this very closely. And I think this is one of the most significant areas of impact of generative AI broadly. That will not necessarily be seen by the end user in like a generative experience because it's all about improving the process. We've most seen the impacts right now are at the, you know, the coding part of the development stage, the generation of documentation around that and the generation of test cases. But one thing I also wanted to point out that I think a lot of folks are missing, and I'm curious as to what you all are doing around this also, is that I have not seen a tremendous amount of uptake in the data science world for using Turing bots to help to build data science models and also to help, you know, build like the deployment packages around them as well. And I think that that's a big opportunity for analytics and data science teams that hasn't necessarily been captured yet.
I think we're doing some of this, and I'll have to kind of come back to you specifically on the data science end of it. I mean, for us, this is an actual project. The data science project with, and I don't actually know if we can, we'll just call them what it is because I think there's public domain stuff. Like we've been working with the IMF on this mm-hmm. for years. So that's all data science. So the adoption and use of AI to kind of transform the data science workflow has been part of the initiative internally for EPAM and then externally what we'd like to say we'd like to do for multiple clients. I think for us at scale, I mean, and I'm talking, you know, hundreds of projects like this, we've been moving from developer to now looking at the performance of teams.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are looking at it from the standpoint that you're describing, whether they be teams of engineers or testers or data scientists. And now we're actually deploying agents to do workflow coordination because we're trying to do end-to-end delivery. And this is what I mean when I say SDLC. So we had one group of people looking at just the software development lifecycle. There's some really radical findings, like mm-hmm. radical findings are probably for another day, which were, you know, I was a skeptic. I was thinking, okay, we could make a software engineer more productive, but that just means he or she's going to take the dog for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the output isn't going to matter all that much. But the quality of life for the people actually doing this work will improve because they'll be able to do more of it with less effort. I still think that's true. But then we said, okay, well, what does this mean from the standpoint of how the team works? And what does this mean mm-hmm. from the standpoint of whole life cycle works. And there's huge gains to be had. And it fundamentally changes the work. It's not the same team, not the same workflow, not the same anything, which I think is really exciting. And why my question of what do you think happens to the economics is so material, because
I agree.
The organization is different.
Well, yes. And I think the question there is we don't really, and like, it's going to come from folks like you all actually building this in real time to come to the understanding of what the new shape of work looks like around this stuff. And I think what you are doing really highlights, you know, how early we are in all of this. So, you know, well, from what we've been seeing, most folks who are rolling out generative AI tools, copilots, what have you, you know, are doing it on, you know, small teams or in, you know, as individuals on specific teams that it's being rolled out to. And even if it's being rolled out to like a whole bunch of people, they are not being instructed necessarily on how to use it as a collaboration tool between all of them, rather than just as a way to enhance individual productivity. And I think the combination of using the tool itself, and then, as you mentioned, using external agents that then enhance the way that people coordinate with each other, that is really the very interesting thing about how we start to change the shape of the future of work. And one of the big things about this that I think is important that you alluded to is that, you know, I was talking about this last year where lots of people were worried about job replacement and, you know, things of that nature. And, you know, while that is a very legitimate concern, you know, when we're talking about a job, like a job is an arbitrary category that we create. Like it is a bundle of tasks that we have decided this is a job and this is carved out over here. So when we're introducing new technologies like this, I think it's important to recognize, you know, that set of tasks will shift and change, and understand, like, being aware that that is a shift and a change, but whatever comes out on the other side is not necessarily like completely different. It might be a ship of Theseus type of situation where all the pieces get replaced eventually, but it's not, you know, a one-to-one change. And that I think is very important for how we look at sort of how teams change moving forward with all this type of stuff. But that I think is the really, really interesting economic impact that is hard to even really project and forecast at this point in time, because in the same way we didn't really understand how, let's say, you know, smartphones would change the way that people would collaborate and do business and things like that. Like, you know, my ability to fully communicate with my team while I'm at a conference or whatever it is, and I'm like on the show floor, I'm on a plane or whatever it may be, that really changes the speed and productivity and like communication capabilities of working. How would you estimate the impacts of that in 2007, 2008? It would be very, very hard to do. So I think we can start to get glimmerings of sort of where this is going. But in terms of what the final shape is, I think we really, I really don't know. But I do think that the methods of collaboration are going to be greatly enhanced, particularly when we think about interacting between teams. So if we go back to like the multimodal aspect of this, I think that is one of the places that is really going to help bridge some of these communication gaps that just text would not do. So one of like my favorite things to do with the multimodal models to demonstrate them is to like grab a random like cloud service implementation and ask a multimodal model to describe how I would implement that on my own services. And they generally give like pretty good answers. And at least as a business person, that's a good way to say, okay, I have this like application developer who's trying to make an update to the application. I have like a business requirements meeting with them next week. I have this diagram. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. You can ask a multimodal model to help you describe it to you, or going the other way, you're a business person, you write a requirements set for a potential application, you ask a language model to, you know, give an entity relationship diagram of how that might work, augmented by your enterprise, you know, data about how your data set or data flows work. That can really speed along the whole development process. So yeah, I think there's so many aspects of how the overall SDLC and even like organizations overall can enhance their communication and work around this. And sorry, I know this is a bit of a rant, but I'll just close this off with this one thing that last year I really started, one thing I talked about early on that I sort of dropped off a bit on, but I think you've kind of brought up, is that we might be moving to a really a golden age of communications, at least in employment communications between folks with this stuff, by allowing us to communicate the style that we want using these tools, as well as being able to ingest information in different formats. So I think that's a very, very exciting aspect of the economic impacts of all this stuff, is it's not just individual, but it's going to be collective for sure.
I mean, that's what we're betting on as well. And, you know, I kind of hate to say it because it sounds a little bit jaded, but I mean, I do think we could use the new technology to make work more fun for people. I think fun, not just, you know, foosball and whatever the tech bro culture brought us many years ago, but like this idea that I'd like to see our development teams adopt is not just to deeply understand what we're doing, but really why we're doing it. And I think the multimodal LLMs give an opportunity to people to kind of develop in an enlightened way. I hate to kind of use such rural language, but that's a problem, actually. A lot of software engineering, particularly of complex systems, is done in a compartmentalized kind of, you know, epic use case kind of function point way. And people lose the transformational purpose of the thing they're doing because they're working on a task. So for me, I think that the real opportunity is to kind of bring the meaning back and turn that into a lot more fun and a lot more creative ways of working.
Yeah, I would agree.
We're experimenting.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would almost put it to not have like people get the wrong idea, not fun, but like flow state and increasing the capability of having that at work. I think that is definitely like a big part of the potential here. And I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen in the software development space, I'm curious if you all have seen this or maybe in the Copilot space, is that, you know, a lot of the benefits are gained from having the Copilot in the environment that you are working in so that you don't have to task switch and go out to Stack Overflow or whatever it is, like even external ChatGPT instance, you can stay directly in your IDE and keep working there.
I think that's what our folks are saying. And in fact, they're using the same language you are, which tells you I'm more of a marketer than a developer. They use the term flow. I use the term fun because I actually think fun is more fun.
I agree, fun is more fun.
So turning a little bit back to kind of our serious discussion, you know, so I wanted us to kind of go through a bit of a checklist, if you're up for it, for our companies, for our clients collectively, our joint clients, who are looking at not just sort of saying, are we doing AI or not? Because I think most of them have said, yeah, we got to do something for the bare minimum that our board tells us we have to do something. But how would you recommend we actually kind of do a stepwise approach to building and executing an AI strategy?
So there's a lot of pieces with this, so we'll just take a couple of them. So at the first step, I would say don't have a separate generative AI strategy from your overall AI strategy. I think that that was a trap that a lot of folks fell into in 2023, and folks are now dealing with reconciling that. The folks that didn't do that are able to move more quickly with kind of selecting and implementing their use cases. So that's the first piece, is kind of keep a cohesive overall AI strategy for the organization. Don't try and break it up into, you know, AI, generative AI, and two specific areas. The other piece that I would say, building on top of that, is when you are looking at, you know, these use cases and kind of bringing them in, doing a triage of whether this is mostly going to be a large language model supported generative AI use case, or whether this is going to fall more into standard machine learning, predictive analytics, et cetera, and your data science team and whatnot. And that can be a kind of a key triaging point for a lot of organizations that are overwhelmed with use cases, is to basically say, okay, we actually don't need to do nearly as much work as we thought we did because our data science team can handle a lot of these, or, you know, a lot of these are just not feasible right now. Another important piece of this strategy is when you are kind of looking at the potential technologies, use cases, et cetera, to build a either a steering committee or a selection team that has a level of seniority that is able to give a definitive thumbs up, thumbs down, move forward with this, do not move forward with this, that will not be checked by another, or not checked, but will not be blocked by some other part of the organization down the road. And so what that means in practice is that oftentimes the folks who are deciding on, you know, how you're triaging your AI use cases has someone from the business, someone from software development, oftentimes someone from the CIO office leading, and then somebody from the legal or compliance group to make sure that it's in line with whatever data and security requirements you have. So those are some of the key pieces. But then also, we're, you know, a big important part of these is to also recognize that lots of your AI capabilities will probably come from your existing either, you know, application providers or your existing custom development work providers, you won't necessarily have to build it out yourself. So for organizations that are moving into this, it's also important for whoever that, you know, the AI governance steering committee is to do an inventory of what your vendor providers are and to get an idea of what AI capabilities they might be introducing into their application. Because, you know, as we were talking about economics before, you know, vendors have been trying to figure this out all over the place. And while many of them are offering generative AI capabilities as an additional cost or as an add-on, some are not. And some are starting to offer it as kind of a baseline part of the application. And if you are a IT or a tech leader, and all of a sudden, you know, your CRM application has some, you know, large language model supported capability within it, and it's, you know, for free, if you don't know about it, that could lead to some, you know, problematic decision-making within your organization. And so keeping, like, almost doing like a double down or a recheck of what is going on in the organization is a really important part of making sure that the decisions that are made down the road are not going to negatively affect the overall strategy. But I think those are some of the core elements. Obviously, there's much more around that, but those are some core pieces that we have folks focus on to really get a good base for this stuff.
So I think we're coming here to the end of our time. Just kind of one last question for you, which I'm sure we'll need more time. So your thoughts sort of on what people need to do, in this case, companies need to do to kind of get set for some of the data and data governance challenges around both consumption and then production of data coming out of these various kind of AI investments.
Yeah, so I would say that overall, having a broad data governance and management strategy and team is really important for this stuff. Particularly when looking at the generative AI side, it's important to get a good sense of sort of what your various enterprise data sources might be and how you can build data connectors to those. If we're talking about kind of the predictive AI space, you know, that has a lot to do with a lot of more known requirements and functionalities like, you know, data ingestion, preparation, stuff like that to normalize data and things of that nature that we've dealt with for a number of years. Some of the new stuff that is coming in with generative AI that data teams need to be aware of on top of, you know, our kind of like standard, you know, metadata management and whatnot is how are you ingesting and managing data that is going to be delivered to whatever generative system is, particularly if you're using some type of retrieval augmented generation approach where, you know, you may have very long documents or pieces of content that are not going to fit into the context window of a model. So you're going to have to take some strategy for chunking and breaking that document down into different pieces. And so that is a really important aspect of the data preparation piece in the generative AI space. But then additionally, it's also important to make sure you have some way of building indexing on top of the documents that you're going to retrieve, because large language models can't just like look across 50,000 documents and say, this is the good one. There needs to be a step of, you know, a search, whether that's a vector search or a keyword search, that is run across the information to bring back a subset of it that can actually be ingested into that context window of the language model. So those are some pieces. And then, you know, I think overall, we're seeing folks that are getting mature with this or having kind of broad-based data and model ops practices that blend across the entire life cycle. So you have an understanding, okay, where is data coming from? What is its lineage? How is it being used in training? And then also, you know, what data is being generated and collected in production? How is it affecting the model in terms of accuracy and drift and stuff like that? So there's a lot of considerations that need to go in this for the mature side, but just sort of starting with, okay, what are our data sources and how do we have access to them for ingestion and indexing? That's a crucial core piece of this.
All right. Well, I think for next time, we can talk about things like synthetic data.
Yeah,
I think that'll be really fun.
That'll be so
exciting. But for this time, I think we might be out of time. Thank you so much, Rohit.
Of course, of course. It is always so delightful to talk to you.
This has been The Resonance Test, a podcast from EPAM Continuum. EPAM Continuum integrates business experience and technology consulting focused on accelerating breakthrough ideas into meaningful impact. Why do we do this? Because real opportunities aren't siloed. Rohan Curran, thank you so much for joining us. Elena Schechter was our interviewer. Cheers to Kip Palalas, our sound engineer extraordinaire, for getting this podcast recorded. Applause to Ken Gordon, our producer, for all his masterminding behind the scenes. I'm your host, Allison Coton. Until the next one, thank you.